Dr. Eli Kahan is a journalist in residence at Boston Children's Hospital who wrote about prior authorization in the August 30th issue of JAMA, which was formerly known as the Journal of the American Medical Association, but now goes by JAMA. Eli, thank you so much for being with us on Health Center in the Catskills today.
Thanks so much for having me, Diana.
So, explain what prior authorization is and what it entails.
Yeah. So prior authorization, as many of your listeners unfortunately may be familiar with, is the process in which the insurance companies ask basically for additional information and basically require the process of giving permission to patients and to providers before additional tests can be ordered.
Now, prior authorization, as you point out in your commentary, really originated in the 1970s as a way to control the expenses and unnecessary, maybe low-value tests and interventions. Was the intention good or was it misguided?
I think the intention was good. What we know is that US healthcare expenditures, the amount of money the country spends on healthcare, is about a fifth of the economy now, which is certainly was less in the 1970s. But even at that time, there was concern about the amount of money that we were spending on healthcare, as well as the rate of change in the amount of money that we were spending in healthcare. It was increasing. And part of the way in which we're spending additional money is a sign of progress. Medicine has progressed. We have amazing therapies that can save lives, change lives, do all sorts of things that we never could do before. And those are expensive. And oftentimes those are very worthwhile. We also know that there's a lot of sort of care that takes place in medicine that is what the experts would call low value. It doesn't add a heck of a lot. It isn't really expected to change the diagnosis we give to patients. It isn't really expected to change the way in which we see their illness progress. And so the idea of prior authorization was sort of a combination of healthcare economists and doctors saying, hey, maybe we can curb some of this unnecessary spending by putting some additional hurdles. Especially some additional hurdles when it came to the least necessary elements of care.
But today we have particularly, and you write about Medicare Advantage plans as using prior authorization in particularly egregious ways and too much. And first, let's talk about what is a Medicare Advantage plan. We talked about this before on Health Center in the Catskills, but I want to make sure that people understand the difference between a Medicare Advantage plan and the traditional Medicare plan. And what is Medicare Advantage plans and what evidence do we have that they are misusing prior authorization from that original intent?
Yeah, let me take the first question first. So Medicare Advantage comes out of a movement to say, hey, maybe there's a different way we can pay for healthcare. So historically, the way that the country has paid for healthcare through private insurance as well as public insurance programs like Medicare and Medicaid is to reimburse for care, which says I get one ultrasound, the doctor sends the bill to Medicare and Medicaid. Negotiates a rate or says we're going to pay some known rate for that ultrasound, and they pay it. There isn't really a process of saying, hey, let's kind of set up the system in any way to dissuade people from getting, one more ultrasound or one more additional test. The system basically says, if you provide the care, we'll pay you back for it. Medicare Advantage comes out of a movement called the pay for value, fee for value movement, as opposed for the fee for service movement. The fee for value movement says, hey, in order to care for Diana and Eli, we, the insurer, will pay you, the healthcare organization, a fixed amount of money every year. Maybe we'll give you $1,000 a year, probably a lot more than that, but we'll give you $1,000 a year to care for Diana and Eli. Whatever of that you spend, sort of If you're able to save money and your outcomes are just as good, good for you. You made money. That's excellent care you're providing. You deserve to make additional money on that because you're a high performing healthcare organization. If you spend more than $1,000, well, the risk is on you. And you're going to bear the cost of spending more than $1,000 because we've decided that on average, Diana and Eli should cost about $1,000 a year. If you're paying more than that, maybe that's indicative that you are providing low value care, all else equal. So that's sort of where Medicare Advantage programs come from, is it's the latest iteration to try to say, let's set up the incentives in the system so that the healthcare providers are not doing all the unnecessary services, knowing that they'll get paid back. Let's set up the system so the goal is for the Medicare providers to keep people as healthy as they can, as at low of a cost as they can.
And what has happened evolved is that these Medicare Advantage plans go after the healthiest older people and offer them some nice services, whether it's with hearing and vision and what have you. But then the reports are that they're being denied care when they really need it and are in an acute situation. What evidence do we have that they are abusing the prior authorization the prior authorization as it was originally intended?
Yeah, whether they're abusing prior authorization is sort of in the eye of the beholder. But certainly we know that they're using prior authorization at exceptionally high rates. The most recent figure is that Medicare Advantage plans initiated 46 million prior authorizations. I believe it is in 2022. That figure is out of Kaiser Family Foundation. The numbers are in the article. And that's the latest data. So, I think even the health economists who would say, well, we could predict that prior authorization would be a natural outcome for insurers trying to set up roadblocks to reduce the amount of low value care. I think 46 million is probably a figure that people didn't expect. We're seeing that also the rate of prior authorization is growing really fast. And that 46 million is an increase from, on the order of 30 million last year. Of course, the number of people enrolled in Medicare Advantage plans is increasing, but still the rate of change and the increase in the amount of prior authorization that these programs are using has concerned patients, has concerned doctors, but also has raised eyebrows in the federal government. And the federal government has heard has done hearings on this. The Office of the Inspector General at the Department of Health and Human Services has issued a report on the rate of prior authorization. And I think the most telling sign is that they found that, I believe the figure is 13% of these prior authorizations were issued on elements of care that were quite clearly supposed to be covered. Well, maybe life-threatening, but very obviously based on the legislation of Medicare and Medicaid, these are services that should have been covered. And so when the federal government is saying, hey, you're initiating prior authorization on services we know 100% should be covered, the question then emerges, well, how many prior authorizations are you issuing on services that probably, based on best opinion, but not in the letter of the law, should be covered? And certainly on those on that percentage that of services that are required to be covered by law, the question is then, well, what kind of burden are these plans placing on providers and on patients when they're prior authing even things that we know legally should be covered?
So talk about what the impact is on patients.
Well, I think you don't have to go very, statistically, if you walk down your block, there's probably somebody, or you call up, your second cousin, the odds are that somebody has experienced a prior authorization. These are tremendously common. And I think most people don't remember them particularly fondly. I mean, the process of a prior authorization is basically you either requesting a service in advance or undergoing an element of healthcare, being told that your insurance is not going to cover this unless XYZ, you scurrying to your doctor or whoever they, you know, whoever the healthcare provider is to saying, hey, A, what the heck does this mean? B, can you help me out? Then the doctor either saying, well, we're happy to help you out, which doctors are spending tons of time on this, or saying, we're happy to help you out. And also you have to do your own self-advocacy. Then both parties working independently to get in touch with the insurance company, provide additional information that, again, the Office of the Inspector General has shown that often the plans have this information available, but they request it anyway. So the burden falls upon providers and patients to give that information. And eventually, at the end of that, maybe you get, you know, your prior authorization approved. Maybe you get it denied, to which you have to appeal, and you're entitled to multiple appeals, but each one of those appeal processes is increasingly burdensome. Maybe you have to do, if you're a doctor, what's called a peer-to-peer consultation. So the doctor has to arrange a time to speak on the phone with another healthcare provider who's associated with the insurance for them to review this sort of verbally, and for the doctors to sort of convince orally this insurance representative to try to approve the prior authorization. All of that said, it's just a huge pain in the tush for everybody involved. It's a huge loss of time. And, you know, even if you were able to say, hey, let's assume everybody has as much time in the world, which we don't. There's immense physician shortages across the country. There are lots of people who are working and caregivers for parents and loved ones and children. And so, you know, this time suck is not a benign thing at all. But even if you disregarded the entire time suck and you disregarded the expense of gathering this information and all that, you would still have delays in care at the end of this process. And that's something that certainly lots of doctors are concerned about, is the extent to which prior authorizations delay care, especially in conditions that are time sensitive.
Yeah, and I think that there have been actually some news reports and cases of people who died because they couldn't get the prior authorization in a timely manner. And I think you cite in your article that about 1/4 of 1,000 physicians who were surveyed by the AMA in December of last year reported a serious adverse event due to delays associated with prior authorizations. Of the respondents, 13% reported a life-threatening event, and 7% reported that prior authorizations led to permanent disability, birth defect, or death. That's pretty stunning.
The statistics are pretty stunning. I think it's worth offering a couple caveats. This survey was done by the American Medical Association, which is the main advocacy and lobbying group for doctors. So, of course, the AMA, A, doesn't want doctors spending their time to do this because all the doctors are calling into the AMA and saying, hey, we got to get rid of prior authorization. B, doctors want to do what they want to do. So even if they were okay spending the time on it, they just feel like the chutzpah of these insurance companies to ask them to provide additional information when their clinical judgment says they should be doing this is, you know, offensive or inappropriate to some of these doctors. And three, of course, doctors want to get paid in full for the services they think are appropriate. So I think it's worth caveating that, you know, all of that is true of the American Medical Association, and 1,000 doctors is not a huge sample. And they didn't have uniform definitions of what a life-threatening illness was or what a, you know, grave disability was or these sorts of things. But I think you assume the best intentions, and you know, those are sort of caveats you might have of any survey. And if you just look at them at face value for what the numbers say, the numbers are quite dramatic in terms of the extent to which prior authorization are causing potentially adverse outcomes.
And there have been some recent news reports about United Health Group, which is my supplemental insurer. United Health Group actually using some pretty horrible algorithms that are designed to deny care. So it's very concerning when, not just under Medicare Advantage plans, but it's spreading to other insurers trying to use this as a way to reduce their costs. And the reduction of costs, as you, I think you note in your article, doesn't help the consumer.
Yeah, the reduction in cost is not trickling down to consumers. It's not trickling down to taxpayers. Basically, if there is a reduction in cost, which there's lots of debate over whether there is, and frankly, the federal statistics show that Medicare Advantage plans are more expensive to taxpayers right now than regular plans. But even if some of these plans are saving money, taxpayers are not seeing that money. The government is not seeing that money. That money is being siphoned off in the form of profits. This model, I think, again, when you think about the incentives of organizations that are motivated by profit, the goal is to increase revenues, which they do by enrolling more people and also by claiming that people are sicker than they really are, of which there's lots of evidence, and we discussed very briefly in the article. And to reduce costs, what you want to do is obviously curb care. So, any profit-driven entity is going to try to simultaneously increase revenues and reduce costs. There's no reason why the Medicare Advantage plans are unique in that. Certainly, private insurers are motivated by a similar set of goals. I should say many of these Medicare Advantage plans, even though Medicare Advantage itself is a federal program, many of them are operated by private entities. So they are for-profit entities. Anyone who has not read the reporting by Casey Ross and Bob Herman out of Stat News really should, because they are as good as it gets in the industry, and they've uncovered some really sort of harrowing patterns of the way insurance is operating the country today.
You also note that post-acute care is often denied as well. That includes having somebody go from the hospital to a skilled nursing facility or subacute rehab or home health services. Why would that matter?
Well, that matters because as we talk about, Kendra Solars is a middle-aged wonderful woman who lives in Arizona, who was very generous in spending her time and very open and transparent speaking with me about a very sensitive topic, which is the health of her father, who is an emergency medicine doctor in his own right, formerly before he retired. I think in their situation, when they faced a care denial of his stay at a post-acute rehab, they really didn't feel like they had a safe option to bring him home. And I think lots of families are in the situation where, something happens to a loved one, and whether that loved one is going to go live independently or formerly lived independently or formerly lived, in a shared housing arrangement with family. The kind of availability of resources to keep that person safe, especially when they're, by definition, more fragile than they were before this whole event happened, is quite minimal. I think also it's worth saying out loud, when you think about the pattern of denials, if you're denying services like post-acute care, the demographic that is the most likely to need that kind of services are elderly people, or people who are already medically quite vulnerable. And so I think it's also worth saying out loud that not only is this sort of removing placing obstacles to a set of services that people need, it's also a specific set of people, which are predominantly the elderly. And so the patterns around post-acute care prior authorization is concerning to advocates who say, hey, why are we almost discriminating against the elderly by preferentially denying or requiring prior authorization of the kind of services they need, including post-acute care?
And that's of particular interest in our region because we have an aging population, and there are a number of people who live alone. And if they don't have, and we don't have much in terms of home care services. So when you're being denied subacute rehab or skilled nursing facilities, you're putting somebody really in danger. And I think that's the other piece of this, that in the short term, it might save a penny, but in the long term, it's going to cost you a dollar with the complications that can occur because the person didn't get the right care at the right time that they needed it. But you also have already mentioned, and you talk in your article about the impact of this on healthcare providers such as yourself. I want the audience to have an appreciation of this because I've read that indeed some people, some physicians are saying that they want out. And one of the reasons is the burden of the paperwork, including this prior authorization. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, it's exhausting. You know, thankfully, working within a big hospital system, I have additional resources at my disposal to assist with these kinds of things. But even for me, when I get embroiled in a prior authorization, you know, it's quite exhausting. It takes a ton of time. They seem to never end. They always need more information. It just drives you nuts. I think in terms of the burnout points, we already know there are immense doctor shortages across the country. Those really exacerbated following the pandemic. We also know that the rates of burnout, while we haven't measured them historically, it's hard to say they're higher than they've ever been, but we know that they're impressive, especially when you compare rates of burnout in the medical profession compared to other professions. The rate of mental illness in the medical profession is also quite high. And so burnout, while it may force you to retire, it may also produce mental illness even while you're still working. And so these kinds of things, you know, creating additional burden and creating sort of additional gaps between what people thought they were getting into and what the practice of medicine actually entails are things that can contribute to mental illness. And the last thing I'll say is, you know, the Surgeon General has paid a lot of time and paid a lot of attention to burnout. And the Surgeon General, you know, himself has said that this kind of activity requiring pre-authorization is a contributor to burnout.
So what's the answer? There are a couple initiatives like the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid is addressing it. What's being done and what ought to be done to ensure that prior authorizations are not impeding care and burning out clinicians?
Yeah, you know, there's some legislation ahead of before Congress. It's been before Congress for, I believe it is now in its fifth cycle, to try to grease the gears a little bit when it comes to prior authorization, at least make some of this information sharing easier, don't require people to fax hundreds of pages, which is literally what people are having to do, is find a fax machine. God knows where you can find a fax machine. And then if you can find one, you have to stand by it for an hour while it like goes through your 700 page leaflet. Kendra, I think hers was 740 pages or something like that. I was trying to convince my editor to put a picture of the stack of papers in the article, but it's just, it's like a tome that you have to fax. So that's the first thing, is lubricating information sharing, including by requiring insurance companies have a digital means of sharing this information. There are sort of additional initiatives that are not legislative or regulatory initiatives, including doctors beginning to harness generative AI to try to, you know, help take the burden off them, write some of these prior authorization letters, these letters of medical necessities, what they're called, and help complete other paperwork for them. And so those are initiatives sort of independent.
Think that's a promising solution that can help from the clinician?
Yeah. I mean, I think like a lot of generative AI, you know, it can get you from 0 to 90%, then it's going to review, you know, it's going to require review for the last sort of 10% to make sure all the information is correct and it looks good and it's appropriate. But I think certainly that is something that has high potential. And Epic, the major electronic medical record company, is also working with insurers to do that. And we know that they're doing significant work around generative AI as well. The last thing that I think is important to say out loud is, you know, there's also a regulatory piece of this, and the regulation, the enforcement around prior authorization has not been there, even as lots of different entities are saying that it's a problem. And so what the enforcement mechanism could be, should be, I don't know, but certainly there are ways of reviewing what insurers are requiring prior authorization for, the ways in which they're requiring that prior authorization, and and sort of how that compares to the rest of the pool of insurers or what the expectation should be. And so it is certainly plausible to collect more information about this, which again is part of actually the legislation that's ahead of Congress. And then based on that information, theoretically, you could do some regulatory enforcement where if anyone's a statistical outlier in terms of how they're using prior authorization, potentially in inappropriate ways, then you could enforce, you could perform enforcement actions ranging from fines to other penalties for that.
So in the minute that we have left, and that's all we have left, what can people do? What do you recommend people do if their insurer is denying care, is denying even if the physician is saying the prior authorization was denied, what can the patient do?
Well, there, I guess there's two things. You know, there's kind of the pragmatic piece, which is try to get in touch with your doctors as quickly as you can, try to work with them to see if they have a method for addressing situations of prior authorization. And if they do, try to work alongside them to do that. You may need to get in touch with your insurance company, but often having your clinician, whether it's a doctor, a nurse practitioner, a physician assistant, whoever it is who's ordering these tests, working alongside them is usually a more effective approach. To the extent you can, wade through your insurance policies before you undergo any really expensive procedures or undertake any new really expensive medications. Try to review and anticipate whether those are going to require prior authorization, because the last thing you want is to be on the hook for all this money without a promise that it's going to be reimbursed. And that, you know, some families can be in that situation where they say, hey, we hope we'll get reimbursement, but others, it's just simply not feasible. And then the last thing is, you know, obviously as a journalist, I think it's always important to share these experiences when you can, but I think using those negative experiences from the position of advocacy can try to push some of these systemic initiatives along. And also every patient that I've talked to about this is delighted to hear that it is not just them, but this is happening to other people. So if at times all you can do is grieve and express frustration around the situation, I think that is also worthwhile to know that you are not alone, unfortunately.
And the Center for Medicare Advocacy may be of help to people. They often help people with coverage and appeals. And listeners can reach out to or Google Center for Medicare Advocacy. It's actually medicareadvocacy.org, medicareadvocacy.org. Well, Dr. Eli Kahan, journalist and resident at Boston Children's Hospital, thank you so much for coming on to Health Cetera in the Catskills and talking about this important topic. It was very thorough and very clear, and thank you for your good work.
Hey, thanks so much, Diana. Next time we'll have to do it in the studio, because I'd love to make it up to the Catskills one of these days.
You're welcome anytime.
All right.